Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com. We archive these podcasts at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Yes, a podcast can be a radio show, and a radio show can be a podcast. And I can be 6 feet tall or 3 feet, just depending upon how tall I'd like to be on the radio. I take my cues from the late Stan Freberg, a great satirist who developed and created all kinds of amazing imagery on the radio. My favorite, of course, I grew up listening to with my best friend, was, and you've got to look it up, folks. It's hilarious stuff. It's fairly accurate historically, but it's not intended to be. United States of America, the early years. And then there was another CD set that came out, The Middle Years, which is also very humorous. And it was always fascinating to me how I would be learning about certain aspects of history and, of course, rather humorously as well. But we're here today. We're so grateful that you're there and that you're listening and that you're listening to many of the programs. By the way, if you are listening to one of these programs and you want to hear more, a lot of times we go much longer than the usual 50 minutes that's scheduled for the radio broadcast. Sometimes we go another 10, 20, 30. I mean, I have to tell you that many of my guests, I would love to go another hour. Sometimes we just don't have the time. You can go as long as you want on the internet. It's infinite. But nonetheless, I've got other things I have to do, too, as much as I enjoy this. So I hope that you will avail yourself of the afterview. That is the portion of the interview that follows the 50-minute mark. So go to the website, richarddugan.com, the radio show's page link. We're also going to be updating and revising the website. I know that some folks have had difficulty because yours truly is living in the past. As far as updating the website, I've been my own webmaster, and it's been the way it's been for almost 10 years. And I haven't kept up with the coding technology, shall we say. So we're going to be changing that, making it much more user-friendly. I always thought it was. But hey, you know, I've been talking with some people, and they say, you know, you need to bring it into the 21st century, something along those lines. Well, someone we are bringing forward into the 21st century is a gentleman who's written a book about one man's journey to heal the heart of humanity. Oh, my God, where has this guy been? Love is the Power, title of the book. Robert Williams is my guest, and I want to thank you so much for joining us via Skype here on the program today.
Richard, it's such a pleasure.
I have to say that I'm going to get started at the at one spot here, and I'm going to tell you that when books are sent to me, sometimes the press material or even a bookmark is placed in the book, just as far as the PR firm is concerned or even the author who sends it, is just kind of arbitrarily placed in the book. But I don't ever consider it arbitrary. It's placed there for a reason, even if it's subconscious or what have you. And in this case, the bookmark fell on the chapter called The Forsaken One. And we're going to talk some about the book, but we're also going to talk an awful lot about what seems to me to be a somewhat similar, sort of similar life growing up, you and I. Although, honestly, I cannot remember having a friend as you did in, I believe it's pronounced Jing.
Yes.
As you were growing up. But I do remember my brother and I especially taking my mom's Indian blankets and pitching tents in the backyard. I don't think she was too happy about that. Sleeping out in the backyard overnight, usually on a Friday or Saturday night. I would always have a little transistor radio that I had tuned to the local news sports station, listening to the Dodgers play. And I was a Dodger fan until we got the D-backs in Phoenix. And I'm so thankful I can say I come from a World Series town now. But you also were introduced to music, and I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing my parents on this program, and we talked about the importance of music in their life. So, I mean, there's so many things we're going to talk about, but in particular, And as my guests have reiterated throughout the weeks and months over the last, I'm going to say, year or so, how important what we are going to talk about today is because of the times in which we live. And I guess maybe it's just, I don't know if it's happenstance. I don't believe in, I believe in coincidences. And so your book, Love is the Power, isn't saying anything new from that standpoint. We all can acknowledge that. Our struggle is in putting it into real practice so we can be the change that we want to see in the world. Let's talk a little bit about this in terms of especially your discovery, if I can put it in that context, of love being the power, and I guess the power to do what?
Very good question. The power to create more wholeness in our lives, which following certain patterns and following certain information fields that are embedded in our very existence, the wholeness that we're graduating to is one with less suffering and less struggle and less cruelty. And so the power part of love is not in an overpowering sense, but in a blossoming sense. There's a amazing, you know, literally there's an amazing power that happens when a seed breaks itself open and the sprout comes up. That's tremendous power that has to go against gravity and the so-called laws of thermodynamics and so forth. But it happens all the time. There are a lot of seeds that don't, but there are a lot of seeds that do break themselves, the sprout inside. We've all seen this. And that is kind of a fractal comparison, that we have the power or embedded in us as a essence is this force, this power that I'm calling love, because it's headed in the direction of a society, a condition on this planet with less suffering.
One of the aspects that you sort of allude to, we've talked about the whole concept of duality on this program time and time again, including my frustration over the ancient wisdom teachings telling us where we come from and where we're going to. And usually it's the one, where there is no duality. And then in my frustration, I go, then why in the heck did we choose this? You know, and yet here we are. It's almost an irrelevant question because, well, guess what? This is where we're at. And it doesn't matter why. The fact is, here you are and deal with it. But from a universal perspective, is this from your perspective, from your understanding in your growing and so forth? Is this strictly, for lack of a better word, a human experience? Because when I think of the universe and its movement and what some would perceive as sort of controlled chaos, where you've got things hurtling, spinning, and exploding, and on and on and on, that's just what the universe does. There's no love or fear there at all. It just right. is. And yet we all acknowledge as we move through these programs and the more esoteric and spiritual conversations, we all acknowledge that everything has a vibration, there's a frequency and so forth, and that everything is, in a manner of speaking, everything's alive, all of those particles of physical matter and so on and so forth. But out there in the universe, I mean, Saturn doesn't express or experience love or fear. A comet doesn't, as far, and I have to, maybe I should preface by saying, as far as we know, okay, do you think that again, from our understanding or your understanding as a human being and as a spiritual being, that this is predominantly a human experience versus a cosmic experience?
It is both. It is a collective phenomenon, collective, including, you could say, and now that I've pondered this with your question, we can say it is a collective venture, collective phenomenon throughout the universe with a very unique situation on planet Earth, in the sense that we have a species, the human species or the human race, that is has been given the freedom of where to put our attention from one moment to the next. And that freedom, that ability to choose, is, I feel, very specific and very unique to humanity. So there is a cosmic phenomenon that's happening, of course, all the time. And in this particular solar system and on this particular planet, there are cycles that we have the 24-hour cycle, the sun goes up, sun goes down, or the Earth goes around. And there are seasons, and there are all kinds of cycles and phases of expressed manifestation. So back to the seed, that's a certain phase, the seed, and then a certain phase transition into the sprout, a certain phase transition into the leaf, and so forth. Unlike the plant, an individualized plant, and I'm saying that carefully, because there is a consciousness, but they're not individualized per plant. There's a consciousness for the nature kingdom, the natural kingdom, through nature and plants and trees and all of that. I write about that in my book, but there isn't an individual sentient decision that a plant or rose bush is making when it goes through its various phase transitions and all the stems, the leaves, the final epitome of its potential, which is the phase transition into a flower. And it's a fascinating phase transition in the sense that the whole paradigm of the plant changes. We can come back to that. But for humans, we are given this very, very special gift to co-create or add our two cents with this evolutionary phase that humans are going through in the birth itself. So it's a great question. It's not one or the other. It's both. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, which has been very metaphysical, and we can go into that, I've seen some of the unique qualities that humans hold compared to other kinds of life.
You also have, and I actually did download, the Heart Plus app to lower your stress, improve heart health, and help heal the world. And mine is turned on. Unfortunately, I haven't been keeping up with the challenge summary, and today's emotion I checked off as happiness. And I actually started this probably more than a week ago, but I think I've missed a couple of days, so I'm still in that 7-day sequence. I have 2 days left to get my average emotion. This is interesting, though. Let's talk a little bit about this particular app. But by the way, folks, I need to let you also know that some of the other areas that we're going to dive into, because they are, Robert, as I've shared many times on this program, near and dear to my heart. You've had a near-death experience we want to talk about that's influenced the work that you are doing now. But let's talk a little bit about this app. I have it on my phone. I downloaded it, I installed it, and then I turned it on so that I have this little spinning globe, the Earth, as it were, and of course the statement, as I just said, lower your stress, improve heart health, and help heal the world. And then you can go in and you read a little bit about the science. You can read, you can then, of course, set up your today's emotion. In this case today, it's happy. Matter of fact, of the 5 days I've listed thus far, 4 are happy. 1 is compassion. But that was when I was doing pretty well. I'm not, you know, I consider myself relatively optimistic as a person. But let's talk about this app. How did this come about?
The app, well, to back up, in 1979, as you mentioned, I did have a near-death experience. And one of the domains or one of the dimensions that I was able to remember when I was coming back into my body was full of geometries and sounds and symbols and mandalas and so forth. I wrote as many of those symbols that I could remember down in my journals right after I got back into my body, and was very, very fascinated with them and began to do research on them. Turns out that there are certain ratios, certain relationships of energy that when activated, they enhance a certain evolutionary force or a certain life providing force that is already here and already as part of our bodies and so forth. So, I mean, the easiest analogy is if you are attempting to meditate or attempting to do creative work or anything really in a crowded subway and there's noise and the air's not that great and, you know, all these distractions, you can still do it. It takes a lot more effort, a lot more discipline. But if your environment is natural, quote unquote, if you're out away from this big cities and computers and power lines and so forth, then our ability to meditate or heal or do creative work is obviously it's going to be easier. So these ratios of energy are in the Heart app are the energies found in nature, and it's related to plant growth, cellular growth, the whole natural kingdom of variety and diversity, and that which we completely respect as something that's awesome and beautiful. I'm saying innately we respect that because, you know, we don't, when we go down and look at the sunset, we feel maybe we're at the ocean, maybe we're lucky enough, we don't have to take a boat. You know, like, how am I, okay, there's 30 people here looking at this sunset. How many think it's a nice, you know, beautiful? What's happening there when we're looking at the sunset, there are ratios of energy on the top of the sun versus the bottom. And then you can do some folks that I've worked with have actually done a analysis of the ratios, the angular, and you can mathematically analyze a sunset. And those ratios and many others are found in our own bodies and found in our own DNAs and how our cells work. So when we're looking at nature, we go, oh my God, look at the sunset. It's so beautiful. The reason we feel it is beautiful is not a consensus of like we're judging something in an art show. It is a reflection of our own selves. So we have that resonance because it is ourselves. So these mandalas that I saw at a particular dimension while returning into my body, I went back and forth these dimensions, and also surprisingly, they're all written down in books that were written a long time ago or originally written a long time ago and then rediscovered as these sacred geometries, often called, or these critical ratios that when activated, they actually raise our consciousness and they propel us into a self-discovery mode that is part of this whole cosmic thing that we're talking about. So the Heart Plus app has those subtle frequencies. I say subtle because you can't hear, they're not in the hearing range and they're not in the visual range. So they're in this special category called subtle frequencies. So when you turn on the app, you're just turning on those very frequencies or these conditions of energy that you already were born with. Me too, all humans and all animals and life and even inorganic properties contain these ratios. So it was a way to what we're attempting to participate in is a better world, a better place without cruelty and suffering. So we all, most of us on your show, in fact, all of your listeners are saying, yes, we do like this concept of less suffering, less cruelty, less violence. There are some people perhaps that are participating in violence and cruelty that have forgotten that that's not the way to fulfill a life on earth. But so they've forgotten, right? They're doing it. They're, you know, we only have to look at the news or just put our attention here and there. We can feel these qualities of consciousness that has forgotten, that has gotten into a series of wounds and fear-based modalities that allows a thought that is cruel or harmful to somebody else to actually be there in the mind for a while. And then, unfortunately, from time to time, it takes hold and they act out on that. But those are not in these spectrum of energies. That is what we're talking about, these innate sacred geometries. It's just, so if we're continually reminded or in the resonance of who we really are, part of the natural ecosystem and part of the natural scheme of our potential, then we're not only going to identify these thoughts that are non-life supporting and not act on them, eventually we won't even have them at all. And that's a fascinating state of consciousness where it's just impossible to think a cruel thought. It just doesn't enter the mind. So the Heart Plus, it's also a way that you can become part of the community. We're doing an experiment that if we can get 1% of any city's population to be using the app, and that's one of the only things that you give when you purchase the app is where you're at, what city, and then we just do observation on the quality of life in that particular city. So if San Francisco gets 1% of its population that is resonating with these natural energies, these natural frequencies, and not forcefully changing anything for the individual. It's not how it works. If you walk out in nature, you're not forced to enjoy. It's just kind of a natural consequence of the energies of the woods and the ocean and so forth. So we're looking at how that will affect the quality of life in major cities. And so that's one of the other reasons for the app.
I know that it also reinforces our connectedness. Again, it Yes. is always the reality that that we are connected, that we are inseparable, and that what one of us does affects those around us. And it's, again, that proverbial ripple effect of a single drop into a still pond, if you will, or still water. And then the more droplets you have, the more ripples, and eventually you've got, you know, I was actually listening the other day to the song by Gordon Lightfoot, the Edmund Fitzgerald, and thinking of the rolling seas, if you will, or the lake that this ship went across, and the winds of November rolling in and tossing and turning this water. And sometimes that's what happens with us. It's a tumult. And I know, too, we have talked a lot on this program. I don't know that I wouldn't go quite so far as to say ad nauseum, some might, that words have power. And I don't care what words you use or in what context you use them. I've talked with people regarding politics, and I get so frustrated with people's comments saying, "Oh, Richard, come on, lighten up. It's just politics." And I sit here because something you said earlier made me think of the wonderful little school phrase, not nursery rhyme, but little school chant: "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me." And that is one of the two myths that I have found are not true. That words have power. And when, if you want to use politics as the example, and I'm not talking current, I'm talking going way back, not just the United States, but even other countries. you're using certain words to elicit a particular response from a certain group of people in order to gain a certain status, power, control, et cetera, et cetera. And if you get it and then say, oh, I didn't mean those words that I said during the campaign. Well, but your intent through those words was to get the very thing that you now have, which yeah. means that your words had power. And when I was a kid growing up, I did great in track and field. I learned how to run. I wasn't going to sit there and get beat up. So I got real good at track and field. And that's one of the things that when I was working for a Christian radio station, they would always talk about the power of the word. I know what they were referring to, but it's the same thing. And it is so frustrating in our day and age here in the 21st century, in the teens, that there are those who will say, oh, I can't trust what someone says because we don't know what they mean. And I've always taken people at their word and that they mean what they say, that they're telling me the truth. And then someone says, well, no, well, what they really meant was this. Well, then why didn't they say that? You know, and maybe that's a naivete on my part from my childhood. But I have a feeling that that's also something that my parents instilled in me that, you know, don't speak it if you don't mean it. You know, yeah. Another one of those little sayings, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all, you know, kind of thing. And by the way, the other saying or myth that I've disproven is that you hear this quite often. You can't change other people. Well, maybe not consciously or even directly, but when you change yourself, you do, because there will be those who will say, "Ooh, I like what he or she is doing. I want to find out more." They'll draw closer, and then there will be those who say, "Oh my God, I don't want nothing to do with that. I'm moving away." You've changed them because they've changed direction. So those three in particular, but the power of words. Can we talk a little bit about that in this context of love is the power?
Sure, and it's a very important topic because right now humans are at a phase where our so-called primary mode of communication is through words, written word and vocal, but it is really not the words have power, and I just want to talk about that because you're absolutely right. The reason why they have power is the consciousness behind the word, the words that are spoken or even written. And what I've learned over the past 35 years working with Dr. William Tiller at Stanford University and other brilliant scientists is that everything, all vibration, has harmonics, superharmonics, subharmonics, and act as carrier waves for other types of information. So, and again, one of the analogies I use is for a short time I was a DJ on KJAZ in Alameda, California, the jazz station back then in the 60s and 70s. And it was 92.7 on your FM dial. So the carrier wave was 92.7 megahertz. It's a specific vibration. And when you tuned into 92.7 megahertz, you were tuning into a particular bass frequency or a particular fundamental, not bass like in treble, but fundamental frequency. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we could play anything we wanted on that. Well, jazz, we played jazz, we spoke. And so that fundamental bass frequency was used as a carrier wave for jazz music. And then the jazz music also is carrying subtle energies, and my voice is carrying subtle energies. And mm-hmm. The more aware we are in general, the more power our words have, because it carries that awareness and that aliveness through the words. That's why it becomes more important and more we have to take responsibility for what we're saying, more than a child just yelling something, because their consciousness is not embedded with the full awareness yet. So I'm talking about 3 or 4 or 5 when we learn how to speak, you know, we say things, and we're just making sounds, a little bit of consciousness, a little bit of intent prior to the sound. But when we get like you and I, Richard, and folks who are talking along a lot, and as it's your profession, it's a good thing while I'm listening to your other shows that you are coming from a good place. I can feel your heart energy, and I can see it, that those words that you're choosing on your shows with your guests are actually carrying life-supporting energy, carrying love. It's not just the words you're using, it is where you are at as you speak. So this power of the word is incremental to our states of consciousness, and extremely valuable, especially in times of great change. They really are powerful.
We are going to take a short break here. We're going to come back because I want to talk a little bit more about your experience in the other world, as it were, through your near-death experience. It's something that's always fascinated folks, myself included. I have not, to the best of my knowledge, I have never had one, never been involved. But I've talked with a lot of people. I'm also very connected with, and as a matter of fact, we actually run an announcement during this program of the IANS organization that's based out here in Santa Barbara, dealing with near-death experiences and out-of-body and that type of thing. I've interviewed, a matter of fact, what was so fascinating, Robert, was I interviewed a gentleman. He at the time we talked, he was a professing Christian, born-again, Bible-believing Christian. And he would tell me that he induces out-of-body experiences. And I'm thinking, wow, that's amazing. So I want to talk a little bit more about those kinds of things as we continue here. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until we come back after this break, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Robert Williams, and we are having, quite honestly, a very fascinating conversation with a gentleman who's had some very interesting experiences. One of these, I don't know if I want to put it quite like that, one of these days I hope to have the experience, but by the same token, I'm not sure I want to go quite that direction as far as having some kind of trauma in my life. But at the same time, I know that there are those who have experienced both out of body as well as near death. I had the great pleasure of talking with a number of people who have had them, and you've had one yourself, Robert. And it's something that it's less unique than it used to be, more because people are now feeling comfortable about talking about it. Give us the particulars of how you had this experience.
Well, you're exactly right. I didn't even know what a near-death experience was in the 70s, and it took me many years to discover others who have had similar experiences. But I knew that I wasn't in my body, and I knew that something was going on. So well, in my situation in the 70s, I was a professional musician, and my favorite gig was with the Beach Boys as their backup saxophone player, or the saxophone player in their horn section. Great time, but I was also very, very sick. And I had grown up with a compromised immune system, so I had problems right off the bat. But by the time I was in my early 20s in the 70s, I was ill all the time. And it accelerated to the point where in 1978, the doctors who I had been seeing for 2 years on a regular basis just were baffled by my physical condition. Why was I getting worse and worse? And whatever they did didn't really help. So it was years later till I found out why. But I can come back to that. The reality was that I was not well. I was in bed. I couldn't move very easily. And I was, I'm 6'3" and I got down to 110 pounds and I could barely wobble around, and my liver, kidneys, and all the major organs were just not functioning. So the doctors said, you know, I better get to the hospital or else you're going to die. And if you don't come to the hospital, then you might be dead in 6 months at the rate you're going, at the rate you're digressing. I had been reading about Eastern philosophies and life after death and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and also this whole idea that we don't just have one little speck of life in the larger scheme of things, and then that's it. So I was actually open for dying in the 70s. I was not married, didn't have a child, and had made a lot of money and seemed to have had a lot of desires fulfilled. But I was tired of being very sick and in pain and all that. But one morning I woke up feeling miserable and trying to get to the bathroom. I tripped and hit my head. And the next thing I know is that I was now looking at my body. There was some aspect of my nervous system that was able to look at my body as if 7 to 10 feet away from it. And that I read many other stories with near-death experience. They're able to see their body and see doctors and so forth. But I just saw my body. That was only one in the room. Now, I go into detail because I did not have the typical looking at the tunnel or seeing the tunnel and the light at the end of the tunnel and seeing relatives who had passed on. And it was just looking down at my body and then accepting that this was my death. And maybe that has something to do with how my experience unfolded, because the very next experience was one of infinite light. There was nothing else besides the light. There was just this infinite light. In fact, the only way I can talk about the light is that at one point I became separated from it. So the first was just light. Without an I am experiencing light. Then there was a little bit of an I, not the I that's speaking with you now in a context like this, but there was a subjective element to this experience of light. And the object, I suppose, was light, but I was so close to it that there was hardly a difference, but there was a difference. And at that point, I was able to have a thought which takes a whole different meaning when you're in these higher dimensions, but no word to describe it, but some kind of a communication, an inquiry about that light and that which was a little bit separated from the light. And the communication was, I had a choice to go back into the light or go back into my physical body. So I asked if I had a purpose to go back into my physical body. I really didn't want to. I didn't see any purpose. I didn't feel any purpose. I wanted that infinite bliss, completely fulfilled state of existence that I'm calling light, unconditional love without an end. But the communication was that I had a purpose. And so I began to then, with that acceptance and that choice to come back, I began to slowly, not quickly, but slowly come back into my body, relatively speaking. And I remember seeing these different things as I descended, if you will. And I write a lot about that in my book. So there's all kinds of dimensions. And I mentioned earlier, there's one dimension full of geometries and symbols and mandalas. There are other dimensions where I could see these beings of light and these wonderful angelic forms. And, I finally got right before my physical body. There's a layer of energy that we were talking about, thoughts and words and actions earlier. There's a layer of energy, and it's fascinating because this layer of energy was the thought forms that were surrounding my body. Those thought forms or those energies that were created whenever I had had a thought or spoke a word, they are energy patterns that stay with the one that was doing the thinking. And at the same time, those energy patterns or those thought forms are part of mass consciousness. So if you add up all the people, what is it now? 7 billion. And you combine all their thoughts and all their beliefs and all their fears and everything else, you have this thick pattern or this thick energy structure that was between that physical body and my higher bodies or celestial bodies body. So, but I got through that, and I that's a whole chapter of my book, but I got through those thought forms and was there in my body and wiggled my toes, knew I was back in my body, that sense of here I am, you know, I'm in this physical structure. And this was March 1979. I was living in Santa Barbara, springtime, by the ocean. And I remember, Richard, just this completely peaceful realization that the garden outside with the birds chirping and doing their songs and the insects that I heard, it's kind of flittery sounds, and then the ocean and the wind, just this experience with now my physical ears and my senses of nature. There was about 4 or 5 minutes where there wasn't a separation between the I and nature. There was just nature working. It's magic. It's happening all around as we look outside. These plants are growing, these seasons are coming, the rains, you know, all this is happening automatically from an intelligence that's way beyond what we could possibly comprehend as human minds. And even our own bodies, or, you know, most of the things that are happening are automatic. You know, I have some little liver cell that's about ready to die and it's going to die and go over to my spleen and all these, just millions and millions of things happening without my awareness at all. So I was there in that state, part of that innate intelligence, part of that miraculously sublime intelligence of nature. And I wasn't separated from it. And I realized that the force behind, or the love, you could say, that power of nature was also beating my own heart and behind my own breathing at that point. So my life force, if you will, was not separated from that natural environment that I was perceiving. But then, Richard, it was my destiny, I suppose. One way to look at it, the pain came back, my headache, you know, my head hurt and all this stuff, but I was definitely transformed. After I cleaned up a bit, I crawled in and wrote everything I could possibly remember down in my journal. And I have those journals to this day, including some of the symbols that I had seen. So that started my quest. I quit the entertainment industry, put down my saxophone. I wasn't playing anyway because I was bedridden, but I moved out of that industry and began to research what I had seen, what I'd experienced. And that started my next phase of life on Earth.
You know, you raised an interesting aspect. My wife went through a heart procedure not too long ago. And I was standing in the hallway following the procedure, talking with the cardiologist and getting an explanation of what the problem was. And then explaining to me how the problem was solved. And it all had to do with electrical impulses, which supposedly fire into the two chambers, the main chambers of the heart, to cause them to beat opposite each other, the upper and lower chambers. And it was the upper chamber that there was a problem with, and you know, and so forth. And he described the problem, he described the solution, the way they resolved it, and so forth. I thought, that's fascinating. But there was one question that, first of all, I forgot to ask him because we were just short on time, but that I still don't have an answer to, and that is, where is that electrical charge coming from?
Yes.
Where's the generator that's causing that electrical impulse to fire that then in turn causes the heart to pump the blood? You know, because it's, you know, it's one of those proverbial, which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing. But more, again, where is that coming from? And it, you know, I've heard it said that, you know, we have electrical charges running through our bodies all the time.
Indeed.
You know, we're electromagnetic, if you will. And again, there's that whole thing you talked about earlier about, you know, vibration and frequency and so forth. I remember working for a station in Phoenix, 1010 kilohertz. And two things. Number one, when we got into the computer age and we started processing audio, you know, some people would look at my screen going, well, why are you processing it at such a low kilohertz rate? I said, because on 1010 kilohertz, no one's going to hear anything even above this. I was doing it at 22K instead of 44, which is 48, I suppose, is somewhat standard, but 44 kilohertz stereo and 16 bits usually, or 32, or sometimes it's mixed. But I told him, I says, it doesn't matter. If I do 44 kilohertz, most of that audio isn't even going to be heard on a 1010 kilohertz frequency.
Yeah.
If you're on FM, like you were, they'd hear it. They would definitely hear the difference between 44 and 22. But it, you know, this whole thing with these, you know, we have apparently all kinds of electrical impulses racing through our brains. It's part of what transmits the memories and speech and sight. And I always found that fascinating that people would talk about how the eyes, for example, the eyes are sort of the portal, but they don't really see. It's the brain. And the ears, yeah, they're sort of portals, but they don't really hear. It's the brain. And I mean, and I know there are people who have been in neurology and in the brain sciences and so forth, for lack of a better clinical term, who've been studying this for years and still don't understand it, I'm sure. But I know we know a lot more than we used to. And so I have to wonder if it's the electrical portion of who and what we are that leaves the body, that discontinues the animation of it. And then where does it go?
Yeah. So the we can talk about this idea of a carrier wave again. So an electron speeding through space or through a conductor, that's what electrons do.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, they're a negative and they go towards positive, and they have this velocity. And as you just briefly mentioned, the electron creates a magnetic field that goes out perpendicular to that path that the electron is on. The magnetic fields are more non-local and have waveforms. The proposition that many of the new scientists are suggesting is that the physical universe, which by and large is measured with equipment that's based on the speed of light, that is an electron or a photon, a light particle that's colliding, and you can look at it either through a telescope or through a microscope or through a measuring system. The electromagnetic spectrum is the definition of physical phenomenon. Now, the proposition is that that electromagnetic spectrum is incomplete, that it does extend to faster than light phenomenon. Now, theoretically or mathematically, both, when we play the note A on the piano, it's 440 hertz per second. So that's A440. And there's also 880 because it goes up an octave. And I mentioned harmonics, and you know this. So it goes up. Now, mathematically, it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop at the range of our hearing. In fact, it doesn't ever stop. The mathematics of harmonics go on to infinity, and they go subharmonically down to infinity, which is still infinity. We wind up in this infinite existence. So within those small realms of our perception, of our physical perception, we have all the great physical sciences and the understanding of our bodies and the chemistry and the biology and physics at large with materials and the solar system and all the things that have been observed, but they've been observed from the limitation of the speed of light. Now, there are some breakthroughs recently, but that's a caveat we don't have time to go into. But my experience and others, including Bill Tiller's at Stanford University, is that the life force that, back to your electrical charges in the heart, the life force, the energy that is the basis or more fundamental than the electrical impulses that get your heart beating, is a non-physical phenomenon. It is a non-physical phenomenon that is affecting that physical system. And the scientists that were, this is a great story, and it's not well known these days, but there was a commission under the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration, that was sponsored by the National Institutes of Health to look at alternative medicine, complementary medicine. And I happen to know one of the professors that was on that committee, Beverly Rubick, and they met for a long time. And they looked at this abundant research on alternative medicine, including acupuncture and including even things such as hands-on healing. And there was so much evidence that those things were real, but there was no way to describe it strictly with chemical equations, chemistry, physics even. Except in the vast borders or the vast limits of the theoretical quantum physics. But the clinical research was there. And so they presented to the National Institutes of Health this concept that there is a non-physical field of energy that contains the information for the homeostasis and homeodynamics of every cell of our body, including our heart cells. So this non-physical, this field of information, is not something that can be seen under a microscope. We see the effects of it. We mm-hmm. see the effects of a beating heart. We see the effects of subtle energy everywhere. We see the, you know, and that non-physical field of energy, they actually came up with a term, and it was published same time in mid-90s, and it was also recorded as a new word in the vocabulary or definition of terms for the National Institutes of Health. It's called a biofield. The biofield. And I bet you there's something on Google about it. And you can go to Beverly Rubick, R-U-B-I-C-K, and she's got the paper mm-hmm. on the biofield. But the point here is a long answer, but it's fascinating because that field of energy is the governing force of the homeostasis, which means the stability and the homodynamics, which means the growth of each and every one of our cells, cells, mm-hmm. and that opens up, well, where does the biofield start and where does it end? And are there different levels to the biofield? Well, certainly the answer is yes. And that's what I'm now suggesting, kind of jumping off the cliff here of that NIH definition, is that these dimensions all are full of qualities of information that affect every one of our cells and that we can modulate, we can interact with through our own consciousness. There's the gift we talked about in the first 5 minutes. We can co-create, we can interact with this information for our own lives, for our own health, for our own families and so forth, and which opens up this huge possibility of affecting large numbers of people individually by individual consciousness, by what's in our hearts, I would say. I almost say what's in our minds. That is affecting everybody too. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about this phase of the heart, this blossoming of the heart that's happening. And so that quality of energy affects our biofield, affects the biofield is not a, it's not a, an object that has a boundary and ends. It's a field that goes in all directions, winds up in infinity But in the process of that influence, you're right. Every person is part of that one biofield of Earth, this one field of energy. And as we participate with our own consciousness, our own emotions, our own fears, and our own qualities of love, it affects every other field. It's the same. I'm using the wrong words because it's one field and then individualized around each body and each cell. That's how we are. That's how we are inspired to help humanity, is through our own consciousness, because there have been studies with meditation and other prayer groups that there is an effect that's non-local, based on a local phenomenon of heart coherence. So back to your wife, those electrical impulses started because of information in her biofield, and that biofield has layers to it of wisdom and right into the area of miraculous healing and all kinds of things.
It makes me think also of the work of people like Lynn McTaggart, for example, who talk about the field. Yeah. And I'm assuming that it's probably pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
I also think, too, about DNA as far as that information and how it – that's a physical thing because we can see it. The code there, the information. But what I find fascinating are a couple of things. Number one is there are some concepts that are somewhat exclusive to the United States, but are sort of permeating the rest of civilization, that are illusions. They aren't real. There's nothing wrong with them. They're not bad. They're not real. When you start talking about this field and you start talking about the ability to communicate, it brings up a subject of intuition, but the things that are not real, that are illusions, are the concepts. They're human, ego-centered concepts of freedom, liberty, and privacy. And that when we start thinking on the higher levels, as we are today in this context, those three in particular, they don't exist, because if we are all connected, and I used to think this when I was especially working at the Christian radio station, and they talked about the omniscience and the omnipresence of God. And that's not to say I don't have my secrets. We all do. There are certain things we really don't want to share with other people, the public or other individuals. We keep it to ourselves. I use the concept of Mary from the Bible, who, when she heard these words from Jesus, she pondered them in her heart, and that's kind of what I do. But I think in terms of this, the character from Star Trek Next Generation, the Borg.
Yeah.
Now you set aside the negative judgment of assimilation of other civilizations. You have individuals who are part of this collective. Each one of them is connected, but each one of them has a different task. They do not all do the same thing. And yet it is to accomplish a bigger picture. I was almost going to say greater good. In our context, as spiritual beings in human form, when we awaken, isn't that along the same lines? And if that's the case, the information that we're getting is neither good nor bad, right or wrong, or evil in that respect. It just is what it is. And it's our choice, which I find fascinating, that the universe has given us. And again, I have to wonder if it's perceived. I wonder if it's perceived choice, or are we being led to believe that we're actually free will thinkers? I'm choosing to do God's will, as it were. one of my analogies is when I, again, it's the greatest education I was ever paid for, to work for a Christian radio station. I have to tell you that. It was a fantastic education. But one of the analogies I came up with was of an individual walking in a meadow, and he has his hands cupped in front of him, and he's holding in his hands basically his personal will, okay? And he's walking in this meadow saying, I just want to do God's will. I just want to do God's will. Now, God, anthropomorphizing here, is moved to tears. Oh, my God, one of my own creation wants to do my will. And the individual tosses his will into the air, up to God, who catches it. And as God is emoting and just moved with gratitude and all of these things, he's compressing that individual's will down into the size of a baseball, and then hurls it back and hits the guy in the forehead like a 90-mile-an-hour Nolan Ryan fastball, and basically says, then do something with the life you've given. You are not a puppet on a string being manipulated by forces you do not understand. Now, that analogy, is that coming from a higher place? Is that just, I'm being led to believe that that is a construct that is viable? I mean, this is where now my brain could actually fry and I'd be done, because I'm trying to grasp all of these aspects all at once of, is free choice, is it real? Or is it just something that, and then of course, then is this world real? And is this an accident? Or does my life really have meaning? I mean, you know, we start getting, I'm starting this, the snowball is getting really, really big, and I'm about to be carried away here.
Well, it's time for the heart then, because I can totally relate to what you're saying. And we have various aspects of our own consciousness, our own aliveness, our own nervous systems. And we have a mind that likes to figure things out, that its role is to come to a conclusion, come to an understanding, conclusion. And in my own experience, I remember coming to certain conclusions about my life, even as a teenager, and then those conclusions were thrown out the window because something would happen that was not at all what I had concluded life was all about. And after a while, we begin to realize that the mind is quite limited with its ability to comprehend the mystery of life. But we're not at loss. We're not at a loss at that point. But I want to throw this in because I love the concept. The more confused we are at certain times, not all the time, but the more confused we are, especially with these questions, mm-hmm. that means we're on the right path. That means that's a good symptom, because if we are able, and that's, so you're
thought I was going crazy.
You're not going crazy. Well, it feels like that for all of us sometimes. If we are feeling like we're going crazy, that means we're getting closer to our hearts, because our hearts, the reality of the heart, the way that field of energy functions from our fourth energy center. And I'm talking about, I should clarify, the energy fields or the energy nodal points. You've heard of the seven chakras. So in this context, I'm talking about the one that's midway between the upper three and the lower three in the heart, right around close to the physical heart. So the heart chakra has the ability to take both extremes of concept, reality, energies, and rectify them and reconcile the paradoxes. And in the mind, you can't do that. That's why that's the purpose of these Zen koans and these questions that you can't really answer with the mind. You either get continually frustrated because what's the sound of one hand clapping and all those kind of questions. Mm-hmm. Then the mind says, well, it's just kind of a swish sound, you know, it tries to come up with some kind of answer for that. But the reason why those questions were asked is to evoke the heart, because then in the realm of the heart, we use the mind as a servant to aid our lives, and the thoughts occasionally are quite useful. Where did I leave the keys, and where is the store, and all that? But in terms of our quality of aliveness, our quality of wholeness, that's a function of our heart chakras, which is combining all the seven chakras and all the minor chakras, the 14, and it goes on and on, into a unification of beingness that is showing itself more and more as presence, as aliveness in this moment. And then once that is realized more and more often, we all get glimpses of it where we're beyond ourselves and we're not unconscious. We are beyond ourselves. We're walking down by the beach or we're just driving. Some kind of epiphany happens, some awakening of what's always there, this unconditional love. That's the kind of love I'm talking about in the book I wrote. This epiphany that happens, and as those of us who have been around the block, we know that they happen just when we least expect it, or sometimes when we do expect it. We go to a concert and we get wrapped up in the music, and it's such a fantastic experience, and all the audience is going right with the music, and we're in this place. We're not thinking at that state. We're not analyzing the music of B minor 7 going to a dominant, E, all that stuff. It's just that's where the mind actually can interfere with our ability to be in the moment and enjoy the joy that comes in those situations, such as at concerts or down by the beach or in just between thoughts. Those moments reveal what is always the case. It's not something we accomplish. It's not something that we earn. We have a goal, we go out and we accomplish it. We achieve this state. It is something that is realized. And like you say, the answers that are given through us in our minds and with other great minds are valuable to a certain point. And then it's like we come to the end of the valley, and we have to, or the end of the right up to the cliff, and we have to take a leap of faith into our hearts and trust that heart energy, which is non-linear, which is non-logical in most cases, which is knows from this holistic, from the biofield that contains all of things all at once. And so the intelligence that arrives via that construct, that portal of opening, is this higher love. It is full, talking about carry waves. The consciousness then becomes divine consciousness, you could say. I could say that. Divine consciousness, not in an anthropomorphic way, not a guy with a beard that's making choices for us or punishing us, but just a realm of information. And there are beings, but a realm of information that is always looking at, or always considering, like this cosmic computer, everyone all at once, or the whole of the planet all at once. It's a higher state of consciousness. And many indigenous cultures that have been researched by a lot of Western minds in particular, they can't figure out how there's no war. Why is there any war? Why isn't there any conflict? They don't have words for conflicts. They don't have words for war or fear, because that tribe, and we feel like we're so superior because we go in there and we have all our computers and all these things that are technical. But these tribes that are living still, a few of them still are alive and well in their little communities, they are aligned naturally through their heart chakras with nature itself. So I remember reading like the Cherokee priests, I can feel the deer. It's now time to go hunt. After we pray for permission to kill the deer, yes, important, honoring our environment. That's all a heart-centered functioning society. Then the warriors go out, they kill the deer with honor, and they pray forgiveness, and or they pray for any suffering they cause that animal, and then they bring it back. And there's a whole ritual that the Cherokees used to go through for killing and eating. And if you didn't do the ritual, then you create bad karma. You created some some anger in the universe that you'd have to contend with later on, which is a whole fascinating thing. That's just because I'm part Cherokee. I really got into that whole level. The idea here is that we're functioning from our hearts and are using our minds to get to receive the information like it's time to go and it's deer season and it's all for a purpose and it's time to do this, it's time to do that. Mm-hmm. Our inspirations are generally right there from our hearts and give us energy. Anytime we tap in, that's another thing. We gain energy, and it's not just caloric energy from our food. It's life force that comes right into our bodies and inspires us to do certain things. This is the phase of humanity we're now living.
Where, in your perspective, do you think or feel or your awareness tells you that we as a species or as a spiritual being, where are we going to evolve to? And I know that there are those who would say that there is no end game, which frustrates the ego more than you can imagine, because I'm always thinking when I'm watching television shows, what's the end game in this thing? And do I really want to spend my time watching this show to get to that end game, which seems kind of silly and ridiculous? And because I'll be honest with you, I'm really getting bored with television, even the better programs, because it's not the question of I figured it out. It's that in general, the main concept of every program, regardless of what the genre is, comedy or drama or what have you, is beginning, middle, end, and that you've got to have some kind of conflict or drama or situation that has to be resolved, and hopefully within 30 minutes or an hour, it's resolved. Unless it's a miniseries or an ongoing series. And that's another thing I miss too, is standalone episodes. Whereas nowadays it's a continuation. They don't call them miniseries anymore. It's still episodic, but in our last episode, you know, but from your perspective, acknowledging, okay, no end game, I'm going to have to just accept that. Where we are, you've described quite well and briefly where we're going, but let's say, 1,000 years down the road, are we still going to be, do you think we'll still be in need of physical bodies?
You know, Richard, it's a great question. What I have experienced and still am a student of is the great mystery of creation. And part of that great mystery does present us with patterns and cycles that can be recognized as such. And one of the things that is apparent in this current phase of humanity is, we could start with the seasons. There's four seasons, right? And mm-hmm. each season mm-hmm. has a different role in the whole year. In the cycle of humanity, there are also seasons. There are also seasons of consciousness, seasons of life. And bringing up this amazing realization that I had and many others have had, and I believe it is at the root or the basis of our own heart consciousness, every one of us, is that life can be better, and it is possible very soon if we get enough of those parts to begin resonating with each other. And this is not something we have to try to do. This is a natural phenomenon of this awakening consciousness that's been going on for many years now, which is why you have your show and others like you and many other things happening on the planet to raise consciousness, raise awareness. We see these a lot, and this is a symptom of our collective being compelled and feeling like it's time to unify. It's time to come into a not a mental unification. That's a theory and something that can be discussed, but a actual realization that we are one. One of the things I want to share with you, I want to emphasize to your listeners that I'm speaking from a place of collective. This is not about, my book is not about, it goes into my stories, but the wisdom that I write about and I live by is not at all to do with my singular personality or my IQ or whatever it is that's going on in this little container of my physical self. But, you know, the paradox is we have these containers, and I'm communicating through that container. And hopefully, though, the resonance is a collective resonance. It's something that I'm, in a sense, serving. So where I was going here is that we are given an intuition from time to time that life can be better. What is that based on? That's actually based on a reality in a higher dimension. And this is something that I do want to talk about with my own experience. There is a dimension or a domain of reality, the blueprint of this planet, that I've been able to see and visit, you could say, many times. The eye really is a loosely held term. That reality is the blueprint for the next phase of consciousness or the next phase of aliveness for humanity. It is the new paradigm. It is like the blueprint. The rose, the flower of the rose, has that blueprint latent and intrinsic at the level of the seed. You don't see any roses for a long time, but it's the pattern of the seed going to the sprout, to the leaves, and the thorn. All of those phases are leading to the flowering. And the phases of humanity have saturated the existing requirements of survival and war to protect our young and protect our homes. And so this was an important phase of human development, to when there was a shortage of food and so forth, and how to protect our young and how to protect each other from wolves and tigers and you know, bad influences. So it was good. You know, we learned how to clench our fists and hold our food because there was little of it, and punch the bearers because our fists can punch like that. And so that's in the collective psyche, the primal. And I'm not discounting the folks that we always should remember at some point in our day that they don't have enough food and stuff. So we want to collectively raise consciousness so the distribution systems, all that stuff can be worked out. But let's stay on this track for a second. Once our survival intelligence is conditioned properly, we know how to run away from a truck that's off the road or something, then the opportunity of love for others becomes a reality because it's already there. And when I was looking at this reality blueprint for planet Earth and for humanity at large, I saw this beautiful golden light. This was a not quite like gold that you see on, you know, gold necklaces and gold, the metal and the periodic chart, but just it was close to that color. But it was an etheric light that is there. The frequency creating that color was there when there was unconditional love. So I would literally see it when a mother was loving her infant, this golden light between her heart and the infant's heart. And I would see it many times when I was a teenager and in my 20s, but not as much as I'm seeing it now. And this almost brings me to tears when I remember this quality of unconditional love is powerful these days, in spite of the the chaos and the breaking of systems and the cruelty and abuse that's still happening, the suffering that we know all too well, in spite of that, in the midst of that condition, that reality of suffering, there is more of this light. People are loving more than they ever have before. And maybe that's the way to look at these tragedies. I don't like comparing too much. That's a mental thing.
Sure.
But it is bringing out. I came from, we used to live in northern Marin, where all the fires. And when somebody needs help, people show up. They're not saying, well, wait a minute. Before I help you, what's your political views, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, what's in it for me? You know, no, that's not unconditional love. That's conditional something.
Mm-hmm.
And these times of history, and I'm not just with tragedies. And I saw, I mean, we can cry when we see the heroism that is just spontaneous with people helping others in need, or, you know, these parents are holding their children, giving their own life for their children. That's unconditional love. But it's also showing up right now with you and I and your listeners. We're resonating with this field of energy. And that is something more lively than has been for a long, long time, maybe millions of years. And this is why I write in my book that this is a time of opportunity of the blossoming of our hearts, of that love that's not dependent on what we get. It's not dependent on anything.
Yeah.
That is there all the time.
It's incredible. And unfortunately, as most of these programs do, they do come to an end. And we are fast approaching that climax, as it were. I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us here on the program and encourage people to go to your website, which, by the way, is rather interesting. Ordinarily, I would just read it healthyworldproject.com. However, there's no Y. It's health, then the letter E, followed by World Project, WORLD. project.com, where you can find out about the app, you can find out about the book, you can find out about the science, you can find out about just about anything you want in regards to Robert Williams and the book, Love is the Power. And we encourage folks, we'll be linked to your website too as well, Robert, so that people can go straight there and continue their research and investigation and study as well. Because as with all of these programs, we just barely scratch the surface and the time is gone. So again, thank you so much for sharing this time with us.
Richard, it's certainly been my privilege to be part of your community, be part of your show. So thank you.
And before we let you go, three final questions, and you've probably answered them in some fashion throughout the program, but we're going to ask them directly to you. And again, thank you. First question is, who is Robert Williams?
One drop in an ocean of all possibilities. So I'm one drop. I'm part of the ocean. We are all drops, but our essence is the infinite possibility, the unified field.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
To participate in a new dawn of humanity, to participate in an understanding and a realization that unconditional love is the most powerful force in the universe and can bring us solutions and resolve our pains and wounds and bring humanity to a different level of reality.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To serve all of life, to be that drop, and to participate in the new dawn. Participate. That's why I came back. This love is real, and it's part of us, and it can enhance our individuality and our creative impulses as individuals. This is a dynamic that is, I believe, right upon us, and I want to participate in that.
A reminder that the website that we want to send you to is loveisthepower.com, loveisthepower.com. Find out about the app, the Heart Plus app, which lowers your stress and improves your heart health, and find out more about Robert as well, and get a copy of the book, Love is Power. Robert, thank you once again for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.